Nayan. And you know, spiritual progress and spiritual felicity and success, is that something that requires a lot of effort, right? It only requires a sincere act of turning to God, and sincerity is something that we can do in a moment, right? That doesn't necessarily mean that it's easy, but it can be done quickly. And therefore, it behooves us, and it's, we really should, utilize every second that we can, because we don't know what tomorrow will bring. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at procrastination in the words of Imam Ali alayhi salam and the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
This one lay. Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
It has been a series of interventions that gave the impression democracy would prevail and everything would get better. But war, USA style, has been anything but that. Countries like Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and Libya, all victims of U.S. interventions, and they're still experiencing chaos. Why have U.S. interventions been so destructive to have created instability and the people suffering as a result? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at these interventions and whether the U.S. has learned its lesson or is it continuing down this path of intervention and wars with other countries such as China and Russia? First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Journalist and political commentator Samuhsin Abbas joins us from London. Also joining us is former U.S. Army Psychological Warfare Officer Scott Bennett, who joins us from San Francisco.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'll start first with you, Scott Bennett. Taking a look at U.S. interventions or wars, I'm going to use Libya as the first example. We're looking at the way that U.S. has intervened in that country. It backed NATO, and we're looking at the worst fighting after more than 10 years to have occurred just in this past 7 days. It has subsided, but 32 people were killed, 159 wounded. And of course, the government, you have two of them, basically one that shows that the country is divided, even in that respect. What type of message does that send in the case of Libya in terms of what U.S. did there?
well, it sends a message of criminality and murder and theft and rape and pillage and destruction at the hands of the CIA, the French intelligence, the British MI6, the Israeli Mossad, and their puppet regimes of Saudi Arabia and even Qatar, that all played a role in the strategic overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi for, among other reasons, Gaddafi's desire to establish a gold-based dinar in Libya and separate his country from the petrodollar dependency. And he had done miraculous things, you could argue, for the Libyan people and the Libyan infrastructure with all kinds of technological developments. So Libya is one of the most tragic and despairing examples that you could identify, because it had so much wonderful and glorious potential that was just savaged and ruined and destroyed by this monstrous Western imperial model. And it has been left tattered and in ruins and in tribal warfare ever since. Libya will have to evolve itself out of this. But I think it sets the tone that the U.S. policy is based on two things: crushing destruction and violence and enslavement of a country, masquerading as alliance, masquerading as part of the enlightened American EU model, but crushing violence and military threat, and also combined with unnatural social science and unnatural perverse culture, anti-family policies, anti-God policies, in preference for a woke, atheistic, environmental worshiping hodgepodge of nonsense and mental instability. So that constructs both sides of the U.S. foreign policy.
Well, one of the things that U.S. Boasts about is nation building, Seymour and Abbas. And I'm going to refer back, if I can test your memory here, if you recall, when the former U.S. President Barack Obama in an interview was asked about his worst mistake. And he said, which was an answer that he had ready. And he said, quote, probably failing to plan for the day after what I think was the right thing to do in intervening in Libya. So there's no case of nation building there if the U.S. former U.S. president said that. Does that still hold true for the current way that the U.S. approaches its interventions?
Yes, it certainly holds true. You only have to look at Iraq today and what's going on in that nation. What the Americans did in terms of the invasion of Iraq was not only based on a lie, but it was also followed up with no intention to nation build. It was done with the intention of plunder and to pillage and to control that nation for not only their own interests, but the interest of their masters. Because let's not forget, the U.S. is simply, and its military machine is part of the industrial military complex, which is really in the hands of the global money mafia. This is the reality, and the U.S. Army is simply boots on the ground for those that try to engineer the planet on a global level. And America is used constantly. It has been since it was given this role as the so-called international policeman, and it does that very, very ruthlessly, to the tune of $4 trillion used just to basically destroy Iraq. I think that if you count Afghanistan within that context as well, it increases. It also, of course, left millions and millions of people displaced and millions killed. I mean, this is the result of what we're talking about. Ordinary civilians, not just military men, but ordinary civilians, men, women and children who aren't even part of any wars, have been ruthlessly annihilated and killed, murdered, maimed. Okay, this is the result of what happens when they say we're going to go out and nation build. Also, what happens is in Iraq, you can see that whilst Iraq is still occupied by the invading American forces, they have done nothing to build the infrastructure of Iraq. They've done nothing in terms of trying to help real democracy emerge. They're far from it. Rather, what they do is they go in with a plan to continue dividing, whether it's on sectarian or ethnic or any other lines, any other weakness or vulnerability they can find. They'll use corrupt politicians, corrupt tribal leaders, corrupt anybody they can find in order to coerce them to continue chaos so that they can continue to loot oil and such things. This is what their idea of nation building is.
Well, this is where things get somewhat out of hand, to say it mildly. And I'm not too sure how to even address this question, Scott Bennett, but when you take a look at the track record, three interventions in the past decade, of which they have failed miserably. You know, we talked about Libya, then you have, of course, Afghanistan. What worse can describe that? And, of course, Iraq that our guest there was talking about. I mean, you can't say, oops, you know, okay, first time. We tried it, it didn't work, let's try it a second time, let's try it a third time. I'm not too sure what type of thinking there is unless there's a concerted effort to produce the results that they are. Iraq still does not have infrastructure in terms of you name it. Are these actual concerted efforts by the U.S. to keep these nations suppressed, whether it's infrastructure or otherwise?
No, this was an active deception operation. This has been part of a plan that really began in 1990. And the world has been deceived and believed the lies, thinking that the United States, which it had always advertised itself as a beacon of democracy, of human rights, of freedom, of liberty, and all of these gold-plated slogans, the U.S. Threw those up like flowers into the air. And the rest of the world thought they were real, but they were illusions. They were distractions so the U.S. could stab a knife between their ribs when they were looking up. And the U.S. tried to do that with Russia. They tried to dismember and rape and pillage Russia in the 1990s. That's why Vladimir Putin was risen to power to save the country. The U.S. Destroyed Yugoslavia. Then, of course, you laid out very well the 20 years of a military juggernaut empire where the U.S. thought it could mimic the British, and using the false flag attacks of 9/11, go in and destroy Afghanistan, all for freedom and liberty and democracy and human rights and women's rights and all of this other nostalgic nonsense. And then from Afghanistan, which had nothing to do with 9/11, that was all the U.S. CIA, the British, and the Israeli Mossad. They transitioned to Afghanistan, and Wesley Clark, the former NATO Supreme Commander, has confirmed this, that they had plans to take down seven countries in 5 years. So they went to Afghanistan, they went to Iraq, they went to Libya, they went to Lebanon, they went to Syria, they've tried to go against Iran, but they've failed because the world has woken up to their plans and their deceptions, and the death and the misery that is caused by the seeds the U.S. planted. And the irony is all of the death and the misery and the chaos and the conflict that U.S. has sown into these regions is now being visited upon the United States. With the United States very soon, I think intelligence is analyzing between October 29th and September 9th, or October 29th and November 9th, you're going to have massive uprests and civil war in the United States. So what the West has tried to sow in countries like Ukraine, for example, mm-hmm. where, again, they prostitute and they position biochemical labs, for example, in Ukraine, human trafficking operations, colonialization against Ukraine, to use it in a war against Russia. All of this misery, death, and deception and destruction that the West has camouflaged as democracy expansion, the world has woken up and said, no, you're liars, you're hypocrites, you're agents of death. We want nothing to do with you. And I think in the next few years, you're going to see the United States ostracized from the rest of the world because it has become nothing but a walking zombie that devours the world.
Yeah, and to go along those lines, Saeed Mohsin Abbas, the Department of State, Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, says promoting freedom and democracy and protecting human rights around the world are central to U.S. foreign policy. So, based on that premise, if you take a look at what has happened, it looks like that is the stated goal out there for display, but really, that's somewhat interchangeably used when the U.S. wants to spread democracy, because it's kind of like code word for military action. Because that's what we're seeing. When they're saying we're promoting democracy, we're seeing the promotion means military action. Who's benefiting here?
Well, America doesn't have democracy in its own land. What it has is a plutocracy. So let's first of all get the base of America itself. They have a system which essentially plays along with the idea that you've got elections and democracy, but actually the power in Congress is mostly dictated to by the money mafia, by the Fed, by the Bank of International Settlements and its interests. So the global elitist interests are what they actually want. So democracy is just a scam, a sham to keep their ordinary masses feeling like when they go and do all these evil things in these other countries that actually they're doing it for these reasons. So first of all, the whole notion of democracy, first you have to question America as being a democracy in the first place, because it's not, patently not, when you look at, scratch the surface of what they sell you. Then, of course, when they try to say democracy in the lands, well, let's look at how they roll out democracy. Their chief attack dog in West Asia is the settler colonialist state of Israel, an occupying force of Zionists that have something called the Periphery and the Yinon Plan, which is an offensive plan to divide, rule, create conflict, destroy, and occupy neighboring nations, basically West Asian, Muslim, Arab nations, but largely. And the evidence of that lies, with their current occupation of large tracts of Egypt, the Golan Heights, the occupied in Syria, the occupation of Palestine, obviously, and even the occupation of much of Jordan. So those are just some obvious examples of the occupation. And the attack dogs of Israel are given $3 billion, that's just official, in order to achieve American imperialism on another level, other than their own military boots on the ground. So first of all, democracy, you can see the kind of democracy that Israel operates in its own land, backed by America, and you can see what it does is to try and make sure that no democracy exists beyond that. So you've got, this is a nonsense in itself. And as a result, you can also see that that the Americans are actually constantly creating new reasons to create this kind of trouble and conflict, and they're backing despots. So if they're after democracy, let me ask the question, is Saudi Arabia a democracy? It's 110% an ally, a partner, a poodle of the Americans and the Israelis. Is Bahrain a democracy, which they're totally in bed with? Is for instance, Egypt even a democracy? Are any of their allies in that region who they support democracies? No, they're not. They're despotisms. They're vile monarchists who are propped up. So their democracy argument is a complete load of baloney.
Sure. Well, let's take a look at the stat, and let me see what you think about it, Scott Bennett. When you take a look at the study that revealed the fact that the U.S. has waged 400 wars since its founding, and a quarter of it was in the Middle East, or West Asia, as we call it, and Africa. And it goes on to say the U.S.'s U.S. Special Forces deployed in more countries than it does ambassadors. Are we looking at what that drives the U.S. to initiate these wars, which the last time I checked in the last decade or even a little bit longer, there really haven't been any wins by the U.S., no military success that you can speak of, which kind of resonates with what the former U.S. President Trump said, that you spent $2 or $3 trillion in West Asia or the Middle East. What do we have to show for it?
Well, you're witnessing nothing more than the U.S. military-industrial complex run amok, and that's what the United States economy has become. It has become a puppet show of old, drunken, whoremongering generals and their prostitutes in the media and their pedophiles in the Congress, all clamoring for the moment's pleasure of being elected and having money and running this game of death. So the U.S. is nothing but a military-industrial complex. You're exactly right. It's not won any wars of any significance. You could even say World War II was won by the Russian people, who lost 28 million to the 400,000 of the U.S. And I think that is an also ominous sign that the West is so perversely sick with wokeism and perversion and pedophilia and lesbian, gay, transgender studies that it has lost all connection with natural, normal human life. It has really essentially become a schizophrenic, mentally unstable nation and people that are so pharmacologically seduced with every drug imaginable and every perverse form of culture and entertainment that you've created a monster in the culture and in the citizen status of America, present company excluded. There are those of us in America that firmly stand with the position of Iran and Russia and the other countries that are rising up for stability and sovereignty. And I think the BRICS nation is an organization reflecting that. But you're really witnessing the collapse of an empire mentality that is going to collapse with great violence and desperation. And I agree with your guest 100%. The Odin Anan plan, the Israeli divide and conquer strategy, has really been at the heart of these Middle Eastern disruptions, and it's even in place in Ukraine. Uh-huh. But all of this, I think, is very quickly running out of steam. The American military juggernaut is collapsing under its own genocide of its people with its COVID-19 vaccine that has come out to be a death shot and murdered more people than the flu itself. And the rest of the world is waking up and forming their own social, economic, political alliances, divorced of any influence or sure. any participation of the United States.
Well, again, more stats here. Said Mohsen Abbas, over the past 2 decades, the U.S. Army to have dropped what we're looking at, a daily average of 46 bombs and missiles in territories of other countries, and a stat that is very well known, and that's how it spends roughly as much on what it calls defense as the rest of the world put together, which it says that purpose is to project military power globally. Is the U.S. military-industrial complex, which seems to be the driver behind this, so used to getting money from the U.S. government, the reason why they can't afford not to continue this habit? Is that what's driving this?
Yes, but the root cause that's driving it is that they plunder resources. I mean, when they go to Iraq, when they go to Afghanistan, fine, they go in with the cover of democracy and human rights and whatever else it is, or Saddam is evil Saddam or whatever, or Iran is about to nuke the world. I mean, they've got all this kind of nonsense propaganda that gets rolled out first. But they actually go to plunder. So when they went to Afghanistan, very few people will focus on the fact that heroin production increased 40-fold, plus, you know, some ridiculous amount compared to when, for instance, the Taliban had been in power. So you see that smuggling and drugs and the trade exponentially rises when America arrives in a region. And that was funneled out via Pakistan and Lahore and Karachi, and these smuggling operations were very much known to the CIA, and they were very much involved with them. So that's just one example of how they clandestinely profit from the regime. But most importantly, openly, even today in Syria, we see lines of trucks, thousands of trucks daily pumping out illegal oil that they've robbed from Syrian territories are going out through Turkey and whatnot. And so this is, and so it goes on and on, whether it's gold, whether it's oil, whether it's land, whatever it is, the main purpose of sending in the U.S. military is to go and secure those assets. Now, the French do it, the British do it as well. The France just popped up in Yemen, where, of course, America is financing the dirtiest war that we've seen so far with you know, millions of people suffering from famine. You've got Biden and co pumping in this track record of 46 bombs per day. I mean, they do it sometimes through their Saudi allies, sometimes through their ISIS allies, because don't forget that they're still operating very, very much so right. in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, and elsewhere. So America doesn't just do these things directly. It has many proxies. It has many dirty agencies that continue to exact this violence for the purpose of resource mm-hmm. plunder and control of those territories.
I hate to say that the fact we have spent the past 20 minutes slamming the U.S., I didn't mean for it to be that way, but I'm trying to find a way out of that path, Scott Bennett, but I can't, because the final question I have is, if the U.S., has it learned its lesson, can't be applied when we're looking at the way it's approaching Russia and then China. Why is the U.S. out to take both of them on and we're talking about military nuclear powers here, nuclear powered nations. What do you see on the horizon when it comes to that scenario? Quickly, if you can.
Well, your other guess is right on the resource pirating that the U.S. has done. And there's a program called Deep Black, which the U.S. orchestrated for taking opium and heroin from Afghanistan through United States CIA channels. It's Deep Black. I wrote it in my book, Shell Game. And it's a monstrous crime the U.S. intelligence agencies have been involved with. I think the United States of America is in a civil war because half the people have woken up to the lies of the empire, and the other half are too stupid or mindless or corrupted to want to abandon this trajectory. But the United States is waking up. There are people rising up saying okay, no more. You're not going to wage war against Russia, Iran, or China. And I think the Biden administration is doing it to try and distract away from their own political failure that is coming.
Thank you so much. Sorry to jump in. We're fresh out of time. Scott Bennett from San Francisco, former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer. Saeed Mansour Abbas, thank you so much, from London, journalist and political commentator. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tahwe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, calling for good and forbidding the evil. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of calling for good and forbidding the evil in the Islamic lifestyle. This is one of the most important part of the Islamic lifestyle. When we talk about the Islamic lifestyle, when we are being a Muslim, it is necessary that we call people, we invite people towards the goodness. We tell them, we aware people towards the goodness that exists and that is being taught by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah has defined all the good things. For example, in the Quran, Allah says, كُلُوا مِن طَيِّبَاتِ مَا رَزَقْنَاكُمْ يَا أَيُّهَا النَّاسِ. In the beginning, he says, oh, the mankind. Allah is talking to the whole mankind. It's not about the Muslims only. There are many things in the Quran that is for the mankind, which is been said in order to take this mankind towards the perfection so that it stops from performing evil. Therefore, it is necessary that in the Islamic lifestyle, we know about the goodness, we know about the good things, and we call people, we invite people, we aware people about the goodness. The way Allah said in the Quran that all the whole mankind eat from the طيبات, from the pure food. Do not eat the junk food. When we say junk food, it does not mean like the fast food that we have. We can take that meaning as well. But on the other hand, the actual meaning is those things that are not purified, that brings harm to you, which are known as haram, for example, in the Islamic text. So do not go towards that. Eat from the pure food. When you have a pure income, when you have a pure income, you can have a pure food from that income. And do not go towards the income that has impure things in it. Therefore, we must call people towards the goodness, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of calling people towards good and forbidding from evil. This is one of the important parts of the Islamic lifestyle. And we said that calling toward the ma'aruf or the goodness means that we make people aware of good things that exist in this world so that everyone performs goodness. And by performing goodness, we get closer to each other. we can socialize in a pure environment. On the other hand, if there are something which are evil, we should make people aware of that as well. It does not mean that you grab someone's hand and you push them away from the badness. No, the meaning is that the first thing is you need to make people aware of that. And when you see that there is something which is evil happening in the society, you should make people aware of that so that they do not perform it. The way the governments, they make rules and regulations, they make laws. And through those laws and regulations, they try to stop the evil, spreading the evil in the society. They stop spreading the evil in the society through the laws, through the regulations. For example, if we look at the traffic rules, that if everyone is free to go, then no one will stop on a roundabout or on the traffic signal. But because the rule has been said, whenever it's a red light, you must stop. And if it is green, you're allowed to go. Now, if we see someone crossing the road on the red line, with the red line, then obviously he is performing something which is known as bad thing in the society. Therefore, it is necessary to make aware those people. Now, you can make aware those people with the wordings. On the other hand, governments, they put some kind of punishments, like a fine when someone crossed the red line. Therefore, in Islam, it is necessary that first we know about the goodness and badness. We know about the good and evil. And then we make people aware of all these things in our life, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran. Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Afghan women have been struggling for their rights under the Taliban rule. Recently, they have launched this cultural spot under the name of Women's Library. There are more than 2,000 books in this library. Women and girls can borrow books or enjoy reading them here. Meanwhile, the founders of the library say this place offers plenty more than just books.
Our aim for setting up this library is to provide teenage girls with a place to study, communicate, and receive an education. Our second goal is to provide a cultural spot for those women who have lost their jobs and have nothing to do. You know that today many Afghan women are literate and don't accept forced isolation at their homes.
Mitra Kakar, a student of 11th grade, was banned from attending her school when the Taliban took power in Afghanistan in August last year. She visits such places to study books, practice drawing, and hang out with friends.
It has been almost a year since we were left out of school. When the Taliban came to power, we were told not to attend our classes. Since then, I have been going through tough times, but I never quit receiving my education. I got an English class and started learning drawings. I also love books and libraries like this. I just hope our school reopens and I can make it to the university. I want to study fine arts.
This place is also becoming a stage for women to speak out. One of the women rights activists here told us that the Afghan women are facing a rollback on their rights since the Taliban's return to power.
If we look through history, Afghanistan has had many prominent, creative, and leading women in different arenas. But since we live under the Taliban rule, it looks like this chain is unfortunately being broken, with women being sidelined or disappearing from active social life. We will keep raising our voices and defend our rights. Neither Islam nor Afghan culture has barred women from getting an education or going to work.
Afghan women rights activists also call on the global community to take serious and practical steps for women rights in Afghanistan. They say that merely condemnations can't relieve their pain, but the international community needs to come forward to press the Taliban to change their stance and uphold the rights of women and girls. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Rights groups have condemned the death of a six-year-old Palestinian boy, Farouk Abu Najah, who died last week in Gaza after Israel denied him an exit permit to travel to Al-Quds for urgent medical care. Four patients, including three children, have died so far this year because of the inhumane Israeli practice. Getting an Israeli permit to access the health care needed outside the impoverished territory can be a stressful and unpredictable process.
Israel is fully responsible for the death of the child according to the Fourth Geneva Convention. This case is yet another example of Israel's continuous violation of international humanitarian law and human rights law. Denying access to necessary medical care for a child is unwarranted and grave.
We met with the family of Farouk Abu Najah in the southern Gaza Strip, town of Khan Yunis.
When Farouk was born, he was a healthy child, but at the age of three, he started showing signs of sickness and weakness. His health started to deteriorate, and he was diagnosed with cerebral atrophy. Doctors in Gaza referred him to a hospital in Al-Quds. We applied for an Israeli permit twice, but we were told that his care is under security review. Israel killed my son. Farouk died Wednesday night while waiting for the permit.
Over 1,000 Palestinian patients have lost their lives in the Gaza Strip since 2007. The large number of deaths highlights the lethal impact of Israel's crippling blockade on nearly 2 million Palestinians living in the coastal enclave.
The crippling Israeli blockade and the arbitrary restriction have battered the health sector in Gaza. Hospitals suffer from acute shortage of essential drugs and medical devices and insufficient number of specialized health professionals. Local hospitals are unable to treat many serious diseases, and so raising the number of patients referred for treatment abroad.
Hospitals in the Gaza Strip lack many essential drugs they need to treat patients suffering from severe illnesses. under the current circumstances, the health condition of many patients is likely to further deteriorate.
The Israeli blockade has had a devastating impact on the health and the well-being of people in the Gaza Strip since 2007. Hundreds of Palestinian patients have already lost their lives in recent years in the besieged enclave due to the Israeli regime's inhumane practices. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Over 16 months of on-and-off discussions over the revival of the JCPOA appear to be nearing an end, with Tehran reviewing the U.S. response to its amendments on a recent EU draft proposal aimed at reviving the accord. The negotiations started after U.S. President Joe Biden took power on a pledge to correct the mistakes of his predecessor, Donald Trump. That's the man who unilaterally abandoned JCPOA in 2018 and launched a so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. President Ebrahim Raisi has now reiterated Iran's conditions for an agreement. They include the settlement of safeguards issues between Iran and the UN nuclear agency.
What have been raised are first assuring guarantees, second, the verification of the sanctions removal in an objective and practical manner, third, the removal of sanctions in a meaningful and sustainable way, and fourth, an end to what I call political accusations regarding safeguard issues.
Raisi argued that it's pointless to restore the deal without putting an end to those safeguards accusations. He was referring to the IAEA recently asking Iran to provide explanations for what it called traces of enriched uranium at some of its undeclared sites. Tehran says these are baseless accusations coming from Israel. In his presser, Raisi was asked to comment on Israel's recent threats that it won't be bound by a JCPOA revival agreement and it will do everything to prevent Iran from attaining a nuclear capability. The president said the regime can never hinder Iran's nuclear progress.
The Zionist regime's threats against Iran have led to nowhere. The assassination of Iran's nuclear scientists was meant to stop Iran's progress in the nuclear field, but we were not stopped. Many acts of sabotage and seditions were aimed at stopping us, but we were not stopped. And no measure by the Zionist regime and the arrogant powers will stop Iran from its right to obtain nuclear energy.
Deal or no deal, Iran appears set to resolve its sanctions problems once and for all. Raisi says Tehran pursues efforts to nullify the sanctions concurrent with its efforts to get the sanctions removed. He cited a huge boost in Iran's exports since his government was formed last year, pointing to a five-fold increase in Iran's trade with regional countries.
The final act of terror by the U.S. before ending its 20-year occupation of Afghanistan was targeting a civilian car with a missile and killing 10 members of a family last year. 2-year-old Somaya was the youngest and 6 other victims were under 18. 3 adults were also among the fatalities. This deadly strike took place by the U.S. forces amid their evacuation following the Taliban's return to power.
We heard a very terrifying sound. We were running like crazy to get there. We saw a car burning in fire. People were killed. There was a lot of smoke and people were screaming. The U.S. said there was ISIS in that house, but later they confessed they were all civilians.
So, were there others killed? Yes.
U.S. officials tried so hard not to utter the word civilians at first, but later they confessed that the strike was a mere mistake, taking the lives of 10 innocent people.
And acknowledge our mistakes.
The last memory from U.S. presence in Afghanistan is the drone strike that killed 7 children. During their presence, the Americans conducted thousands of similar operations, killing countless civilians. They use this attack to turn the media away from their shameful pullout. They do such actions by breaking legal and international standards. This was a war crime, and the perpetrators should have been tried.
According to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, more than 900 civilians have been killed in the U.S. airstrike since 2015 in Afghanistan, and so far, no one has been held accountable. The drone strike that took the lives of 7 children and 3 adults showed once more that the victims of the U.S. missions are mostly innocent civilians. Abdullah Hamirzadeh, Kabul. Italy's energy crisis keeps getting more worrying by the day as wholesale gas prices have surged to skyrocketing levels. Italy, like most of its European neighbors, has reviewed its energy strategy following the start of the war in Ukraine and the sanctions against Russia, Rome's largest gas supplier, accounting for over 40% of imports. In an attempt to diversify its gas supplies, Rome has sealed new deals with Algeria and has planned the construction of new gas infrastructures, a move that includes buying more LNG and setting up new regasification plants.
Italy relies on fossil gas for 40% of its electricity production, with the consequence that electricity costs have gone crazy. Our industrial system relies very much on gas-produced electricity. The risk is that the products of our steelmakers and of our manufacturers will soon be out of the market.
Italy's industrial lobby Confindustria has warned of the risk of widespread company failures if energy prices keep surging this way. Confindustria is calling on the government to create a plan for rationing gas and to provide new subsidies to shield manufacturers. Gas prices have recently climbed to over 320 euros per megawatt hour, three times the price recorded at the beginning of July and about 1,000% more compared to the same period a year ago. Businesses have slammed the rate as unsustainable, while consumer groups have described it as an emergency.
The impact on the average Italian will be dramatic. I expect a profound reshape of our lives and energy future.
In less than a month, Italy will return to the polls with a large number of electors expected to skip the vote. According to latest polls, 16 million Italians, accounting for 35% of Italy's 51 million voters, will not cast their ballot as, quote, the trust in politician is wearing thin. Max Civili, Rome.
In the outskirts of Srinagar, hundreds of people gathered to attend the annual Imam Hussein conference held each year during the holy month of Muharram. Shia as well as Sunni scholars came together to discuss the importance of unity in Islam, the relevance of the Battle of Karbala, and lessons from Imam Hussein to dwell upon.
Imam Hussein, an exemplary personality, needs no introduction. Organizing such conferences in the current world order helps Muslims understand what role they need to play. Imam Hussein set an example by sacrificing his life and that of his companions. He set an unmatched limit of being steadfast to the mission of Islam. These conferences are important as they help people revive their pledges.
Scholars speaking on the occasion emphasized the role of youth in spreading the teachings of Imam Hussein. The scholars warned people against plot by Islam's enemies.
The current world order is against Islam. It's against peace and justice. Evil plots are being hatched against Muslims to divide them. Muslims must remember one thing. Islam is one religion and we must have strong faith in Islam.
Participants at the conference concluded that the Battle of Karbala is a defining moment in the history of Islam that will continue to inspire people regardless of their religious belief.
According to the organizers of Yom Hussein or the Day of Hussein conference, such events are a reminder for Muslims to follow the path of truth, justice and equality in letter and spirit. And not to forget, the key to greater success of Islam is through unity between Shia and Sunni sects of Islam. Shahane Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
The Saudi Lidwo on Yemen is still taking its toll on the nation even under the UN brokered truce. Yemen's Ministry of Health has held a press briefing in Sana'a to highlight the catastrophic repercussions of the Saudi aggression and the impact of the ongoing siege of Yemen.
We held this press conference to review the impact of the Saudi aggression since its beginning, as well as the aftermath of the siege amid the UN armistice, which unfortunately did not change anything. There are tragedies caused by the Saudi-led coalition throughout the years of war, as health facilities and workers have been targeted, and we explain to the world what is happening in our country under the eyes of the United Nations and with the support of the US, Britain and the rest of major powers.
The ministry says the ongoing Saudi blockade is threatening the lives of thousands of patients by preventing them from traveling for treatment and blocking medical supplies from entering the country.
The blockade is part of the fierce war on Yemen and has directly affected the health sector due to a lack of fuel and failure to fully open the Sana'a International Airport. There are more than 32,000 patients who urgently need to travel abroad for treatment. Saudi Arabia also tends to prevent the entry of medicines that are essential for the treatment of millions, including radioactive iodine, which is used to treat cancer patients.
Even though the United Nations managed to declare a nationwide ceasefire back in April, it has failed to relieve the humanitarian situation in Yemen, as Saudi Arabia is still imposing restrictions on all sorts of imports into the country. According to health officials, 19 million Yemenis don't have access to basic health care services. They say the United Nations is concentrating its efforts on the Russia-Ukraine war, while it should also put more efforts into Yemen to save the lives of millions of women and the children.
Monsoon rains are still pounding Pakistan, hampering all sorts of communications in key cities and towns in four provinces of the country. Roads, houses, hotels and buildings, along with other infrastructures, have been washed away by the flood waters. Southwestern Balochistan and northwestern Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces are now in the spotlight due to the sheer magnitude of devastation witnessed there in recent days. That's while millions of Pakistanis ravaged by extreme flooding are still awaiting relief in remote rural areas.
As far as government support is concerned, I think they supported only 50%. A lot of complaints from the local communities that there is no support received so far from the government. They are demanding shelters, food items, and a lot of other things.
Across large swaths of Pakistan, houses, schools, roads, and bridges have been destroyed. Floods also left thousands displaced and struggling to find safety along with their livestock. Meanwhile, Shehbaz Sharif has visited the heavily affected areas. He has already appealed to the international community to send aid and relief to help them deal with the devastation.
We are doing our best to help flood-affected people. The 30-year record of monsoon has been broken this year. The situation is demanding that we all should rise above the politics and to help the flood victims to overcome their miseries.
Pakistan is 8th on the Global Climate Risk Index for being one of the most vulnerable countries in the face of extreme weather caused by climate change. The country witnessed more rain than ever recorded this monsoon season.
It has been a year since the U.S. missile withdrawal from Afghanistan and the Taliban takeover of the country. During the pullout, thousands of Afghans flocked to airports in hope of leaving the country along with the U.S. forces. Zaki was one of them. As the Taliban encircled Kabul on August 15, hundreds of Afghans swarmed the runway of Hamid Karzai International Airport, attempting to climb onto a U.S. Air Force transport plane. Zaki made his way to the front and clambered onto the plane's landing gear. As it accelerated past 120 miles per hour, he held tight. His body was found after he plunged from the U.S. military plane as it took off, one of the most tragic and indelible images in the final chapter of the U.S. campaign in Afghanistan. We spoke to Zaki's father 1 year after his son's death. It wasn't easy to convince him at first, but this is our mission, to be the voice of the voiceless.
I just want to see the pilot of the U.S. plane to understand how he could do this. The U.S. claims that it supports human rights, but this is a sheer lie. They kill innocent people. They have not even apologized to me for my son's death. I've waited for a year for a simple apology, but it never happened.
Zaki's brother, Zabih, also lost his life during the Taliban takeover. Many Afghans blame the U.S. for the loss of innocent Afghan lives during the Washington's withdrawal.
There is no doubt that Americans are responsible for such incidents. They caused a chaos and it got out of their control. They knew such events might occur. Falling from planes or getting killed in explosions were the result of Americans' irresponsibility and mismanagement.
The cemetery where Zaki is buried is so close to his house that his father always looks at it through the window of his house every day. We asked him to take us to the cemetery where Zaki's grave is located.
The United Nations is also on their side, and so are the so-called human rights groups. The UN and the human rights are just a lie, as they are simply deceiving people. They are more like a mafia, but an official type. They must somehow pay compensation.
1 year has passed since the U.S. pulled its forces out of Afghanistan, ending almost two-decade occupation of the country. Yet no one has stood trial for the tragedy that happened during their withdrawal. There has been neither any compensation nor an apology that could at least calm those who lost their loved ones. Abdullah Amirzad of Kabul.
In the limelight.
Former FBI official Peter Sterzak said in an interview on Sunday, 28th of August, that foreign intelligence services in countries including Russia have been absolutely interested in gaining access to former President Donald Trump's Florida property at Mar-a-Lago. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Xander Landon. The article has been published by Newsweek and is titled, Russia Absolutely Tried to Infiltrate Mar-a-Lago, Former FBI Official. Former FBI official Peter Sterzak said in an interview on Sunday, 28th of August, that foreign intelligence services in countries, including Russia, have been absolutely interested in gaining access to former President Donald Trump's Florida property at Mar-a-Lago. Peter Sterzak's comments come after the FBI raided the property of Donald Trump earlier this month as part of an investigation into whether Trump potentially mishandled classified information that he took with him after he left the White House last year. A search warrant revealed that agents seized items, including top-secret documents, from the property on Monday, 8th of August. During his interview on MSNBC, host Katie Fang asked Peter Sterzak if he believes it's a possibility that the Russians would have been interested and possibly tried to infiltrate Mar-a-Lago to get classified information. Well, Katie, absolutely the Russians, but not just the Russians, any competent foreign intelligence service, whether that's those belonging to China, those belonging to Cuba, certainly including Russia, are all interested in gaining access to Mar-a-Lago, Peter Sterzak responded. Sterzak added, what's especially concerning right now is some of the information that's coming out about the absolute lack of any sort of control or memorialization of who had access to Mar-a-Lago at any given time, particularly in the context of the fact that it appears that classified documents were strewn all over the facility. Peter Sterzak was fired from the FBI after text messages from 2016 were released revealing anti-Trump remarks between himself and FBI lawyer Lisa Page. Sterzak has remained a critic of the former president and published a book in 2020 titled Compromised, Counterintelligence and the Threat of Donald J. Trump. During his interview, Peter Sterzak said that regardless of the knowledge that classified documents were there, Foreign intelligence services are going to have been trying to gain access to Mar-a-Lago during and after Trump's presidential administration. And that's absolutely the sort of thing that the U.S. intelligence community, and the FBI in particular, are going to be concerned about, trying to establish who had access to the grounds, who had access to that storage area, and what they need to do to mitigate any sort of damage that might have occurred, he added. Newsweek has reached out to Donald Trump's press office for comment. In the wake of the search at Mar-a-Lago, some have speculated who may have provided the FBI with information about Donald Trump's possible mishandling of classified information. During an interview on Friday, veteran Republican political strategist Karl Rove said that Secret Service officials